You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 13th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Well, hello, everyone.
It's Kara's week to be absent this week because she is just really sick. She has a bad cold. She's totally wiped out. She said she can't talk or whatever.
Feel better, Kara.
Yeah, feel better. Of course, she'll be back next week. So, guys, since Kara's not here, let's talk about video games.
Okay. Oh, here we go.
All right. We've been playing video games our entire lives, right?
Hell yeah.
Pretty much, since we were single digits. And I usually will play a quick video game when I'm working, just as like a quick break to turn my mind off.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. So I was, in the midst of the hours of prep for the show today, I was playing a little Overwatch. Have any of you guys played Overwatch?
My daughter Rachel plays Overwatch regularly.
Right. It's a fun game. I do recommend it. We should get a group together. So I was playing Overwatch. And I had the most epic success of my video gaming career in my entire life.
What happened? What happened, man?
It was like this perfect storm. So first of all, this is a game where you're playing against other players, right? This is
real people
playing against people. Yeah.
And tell the audience what the object of the game is.
It's basically there's like 30 or 40 different characters you could play. They're sort of prefab characters with, and you're fighting against each other. So it's either just elimination or you have to.
So it's a first person shooter. You're shooting a gun. You're killing the other players.
Yeah, it's first person shooter. And I was playing Capture the Flag. So it's 6 versus 6, Capture the Flag, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the regular game, we were tied and nobody had caught the flag 3 times, so it went into sudden death overtime. So they moved the flags really close together so that it's hard to keep the other team from stealing it. And then, it goes very quickly once you're into sudden death. That's the idea. I'm playing the character Farrah, for those who know the game, I know who that is. And this is a character who has a jetpack and rocket launcher, so she could fly and she could shoot rockets out of her arm.
Wow, this looks like a great game. I'm looking at a video on YouTube. Damn.
It's awesome.
Robots and shields and jetpacks and cool stuff, man.
We should play together, guys. All right, listen.
Yeah.
So the other team grabs our flag and like all 6 of them are mobbing the flag over to – and it's a very short distance because, again, this is the sudden death. They're almost at their home base with our flag.
Okay.
And I'm like, everyone's in panic when I fly over there. So one of Farrah's abilities is you could knock people back. So I shot it right in front of the guy with the flag and I knocked him away from his base. Uh-huh. So that bought me like 2 seconds. It gave me enough time to get him to position. I also happened to just activate my big power. So every character has what we call the Q power because you hit the Q on the keyboard to activate it. And you get it only like a few times in any game because it's very, very slow to recharge. So I had just got my Q power. So all 6 of the other team are huddled around our flag, which they're just about to go over the finish line and win, and which is also where their flag is. I activate my power and I kill all 6 of them.
Oh, nice!
Boom!
Now it takes you like 10 seconds to get back in the game when you're dead.
Right.
So I drop down, pick up the enemy flag, and stroll over to our base and win the game.
Nice.
They talk about snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. But there was just the perfect storm of like, I was in position. All the bad guys were huddled right underneath me. They had, both flags were there. It was perfect.
Did you get the adulation of the women?
Of the other players? And so there's, at the end of every game, there's a quote unquote play of the game. Where they show like a highlight video of the most awesome 10 seconds in the game. So of course that was the play of any game I've ever played that would have won the play of the game. But the good thing is you get to save it. So I have saved the video.
Come on. Now you got to share it. I want that video.
Wait, Steve,
that this is premium content for our patrons.
Sure.
Seriously.
Sure. If I can find a way to export that video, it was epic. I will never get a play of the game like that in this game ever again, because you had to have all of these elements had to be right perfectly in place. I'll show it to you. You'll see how.
Hey, Zenyatta. Zenyatta, is that her name? She looks cool.
I think it's a he, but yeah.
Yeah, produced by Blizzard, right? Wizards of
it's Blizzard.
World of Warcraft.
It's Blizzard, yeah.
It's not Steam. It's not Steam, yeah, it's Blizzard.
Oh, Hanzo. This is the game with Hanzo in
it. Yeah.
Oh, I heard of him. Hanzo man.
He's nasty. If you have a good Hanzo player, like it's a sniper, right? So he could kill you with one shot to the head from across the field. I mean, so
oh boy,
it's really got to be really careful if there's a Hanzo in the game. The thing is, though, like there's something like close to 40 different characters, so there's a limited number of those characters in any given game. So every game is very different. It's a different mix of those characters.
I see.
And you could play any of them. You could pick any one that you want. So usually people get good at one or two or three as their primaries, and then. Like you at least get familiar with all the characters, but you most people will focus on a few and try to become really good at them. Yeah,
I'm happy to hear you having some time to recreate. You know,
well, I have to have some downtime. I can't just sit, you know, at the computer just working for 6 hours straight. Like when I'm doing post-production on the show, I do an hour's work. I play a 10-minute encounter because that's the thing. You could play for 10 minutes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You play one interaction. It's 5 to 10 minutes, and you're done. So that's why it's a good quickie diversion.
Gosh, that was so much fun in City of Heroes, going to do certain series of adventures and learning new powers and unlocking different things like that.
Yeah.
That was part of the fun.
Yeah, I missed that, but this is a different kind of game. It's a different genre, you know?
Yeah.
Jay, how is City of Heroes coming, by the way? Now, this is a game that we loved playing. We played with Perry, and then it ended. But these guys are trying to resurrect it, trying to bring it back from the grave.
It seems like they're making very good progress. The devs are knocking down, you know, each time I read, you know, somebody has solved another major issue, you know, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to reverse engineer. Most of these player versus player games or co-op games that you play that are internet based, you have something what's called a client server setup where... Yeah, so if you have it installed on your computer and you're playing with other people, your computer is considered a client, and then there's a server somewhere. Now, with modern games, people can also be a server at the same time, meaning that they're actually communicating to the other players, and their computer is telling the other players like what's going on. It's hard. It's okay. If you don't understand computers, it's a little complicated. But you just got to think your computer is talking to another computer somewhere that's telling everybody else's computer where everybody else is and what's happening in the game, and then the game graphics display that.
So it's
right?
more decentralized?
Yeah, the ones today are decentralized, meaning that anybody could be the server. So they're just rebuilding the server, so they have to figure out, well, okay, we send this unknown piece of software this code that's coming out of the client software, and the server has to respond with something to tell the client to do something. So they're just remapping or reverse engineering what the server side is doing. And, you know, to be honest with you, it's doable. They're doing it. I'm watching them do it. I'm seeing, you know, I downloaded a demo not too long ago and, you know, just was able to run around into the different zones of the game, which you just couldn't do like even 3 weeks ago at the time. I couldn't do that. It's going to happen. I would estimate, you know, we could be as soon as a year away from playing City of Heroes.
Oh, wow, Jay.
Yep.
Okay.
Jay, I'm on Amazon right now looking. Someone's selling a City of Heroes disc, new in package. And all the comments are like, this game is dead. You can't play it. Do not buy this.
There is something very serious going on here, is that the intellectual property that these companies come up with, when they sunset a game, when they, you know, like there's lots of games that you can't play anymore because, you know, they're not a game that you install on your computer that you play by yourself. If you're playing with other people, a lot of times these games need a server for them to function. And if the company says, screw it, you know, we're not making enough money anymore, the game goes away. And the problem is that there is human history here. There is cultural history, and there is something very legitimate about not having these games become 100% inaccessible for all time. That's ridiculous. You know, I know that there's a lot of intellectual property that goes into these games. A lot of these games could legitimately be, and you might not believe this, but they're a lot more expensive than some of the most expensive movies out there. Games could spend hundreds of millions of dollars or more to develop a game. They could spend 5 years developing a game, and the game could earn the company billions of dollars. That's how big the gaming industry is. It is phenomenal.
And they're booking stars, movie stars, to voice characters for popular video games.
Yeah, last time I read an article about it, I mean, the video game industry is bigger than Hollywood. It's more profitable in
the
Hollywood.
Same thing.
It's a huge deal. So I fully agree that especially when a company sunsets a game, that they should the game should go then into a retirement.
To home. Public domain.
In public sure. domain. It should,
right,
it should
something
be,
equivalent.
Yeah, just so we can continue to play it. Now, some game producers will say, yes, but then we're competing with our own games. Like, why should we, you know, let these people play a game and give it to them for free when we want them to play our new game?
It wasn't free, though. We did pay for it, and we kept it alive for quite a while.
Yeah, and I, you know, look, there might be even some legitimacy to that point. And I'm always going to be attracted to playing the newer, better games. You know, like I'm still deeply exploring my VR headset. I love it. I'm dying for them to come out with that right game, Steve. You know, the game that we've been waiting for where we can play Dungeons and Dragons together, you know, in real time online with amazing graphics. It's coming. Somebody's going to make it. But the point is, you know, these games are just as important as anything else artistic that happens. Just like a movie, you know, it'd be like you get to watch Star Wars and you can't ever see it again. After 5 years, it's gone forever. Like, ridiculous. Sorry, video game developers, but you're going to have to get over yourselves. This is a ridiculous notion. People should be able to continue to play these games or at least see the games. But
yeah,
no,
that's
we should
point.
Yeah. So that's what's happening. City of Heroes, to all of us, you know, the people that except Kara, but the four of us who used to play together, it happened to be one of it was our favorite game. It became our favorite game. It became our favorite thing to do with each other.
And this is part of the SGU origin story.
Absolutely.
That's right. I was just going to say that. That
That's
if the,
right.
That if City of Heroes didn't go away, the SGU might not even exist.
Maybe not. Or, maybe not.
But
it's true.
It was the early on when the internet was just getting good enough to do what we're doing right now, to be having a live conference with each other online. We were using
TeamSpeak,
and then we moved over to Skype when Skype first came out. We loved Skype.
Oh, Skype was so good in 2004.
So much better than TeamSpeak. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And then we were playing games, wearing headsets, talking to each other. And we would talk like we talk on this show. You know, we would talk about politics and news items and science and all sorts of
stuff. Robots.
I mean, the things that Perry would say when we would be playing the game, I don't know what was wrong with me. I should have recorded every second of it. It was insane. He was so funny.
Man.
We had things happen in that game that were so ridiculously funny that they're actual moments between us. Like, it would happen in a video game, but it's moments of our friendship memory and brother's memory that we have with each other.
Yeah. So, our City of Heroes game night morphed into the SGU. That's just a fact.
It was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
Well, we carved out that time like it was a sacred time for us to get together one night a week. You know, that it was a big transition to like turn it into something that we believed in and wanted to do. But it was work. You know, it was a lot of fun playing City of Heroes. You know, but the SGU, I remember like going through that first kind of year of like, man, this is work. You know, like
it's still work. I got news for you.
Oh, it is. I know, but it's a very different thing today than it was 14 years ago. I mean, that first year of transition was very hard. I mean, Steve, I quit my band. You know, I was in a band for 21 years.
Right.
I quit my band in part. Like, you know, I had the SGU in the front of my mind when it came time for it to end. I helped it end. You know, I was like, I'm out. That's it. I'm going to go do the SGU now, you know?
All right. So
we actually have
a great interview coming up later in the show with Peter DeJager, who's a Y2K expert. We're going to talk about the myths and facts about the Y2K bug. But before that, we're going to get into some news items. So there's a Golden Rice update.
Oh, cool. I'm so psyched about this, Steve.
Yeah, with Bangladesh. Bangladesh, of all countries, is on the cutting edge of the incorporation of certain genetically modified crops, including golden rice. Why is that? Well, for a number of reasons, but primarily because Bangladesh has very lax regulations when it comes to GMOs, but in a good way. They have not succumbed to the anti-GMO propaganda. They have commonsensical regulation that allows for things like golden rice. So what is golden rice? It was put together by a consortium of philanthropists, companies, and money donated by, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates, for example. And essentially, their goal is to produce biotech crops for poor, starving people. That's basically their goal. They're trying to improve the nutrition in developing parts of the world by developing nutritionally enhanced, genetically modified crops.
Using science.
Using science. Yeah,
they're
trying to improve people's lives with science. Go figure. and the consortium rules are that whatever comes out of this, whatever gets developed, you know, by the people working on this, cannot be sold. It can only be given away for free. And all of the nothing is being patented. And if they need to use a technique or a thing that's already patented, they are getting the rights to use those patents for free.
Nice.
Yeah. So Golden Rice is sort of their big poster child. That's like the thing that they're trying to develop. And this is essentially rice that has been and fortified with beta carotene, which is a provitamin for vitamin A.
You said they're trying to develop it. Hasn't this already been developed?
Yeah, they have developed it, but they're also trying. They're continuing to be developed, but it's been developed, but it hasn't been implemented yet. But that's the update. So Bangladesh has basically cleared the way regulatory wise to begin planting of golden rice in Bangladesh. This is huge. This is as one of the researchers said. This is not just game-changing. This is life-changing. So the World Health Organization estimates that between 250 and 500,000 children become blind from vitamin A deficiency every year. It's 500,000 kids going blind from vitamin A deficiency every year. And half of them are going to die within 12 months of losing their sight. It's a major cause of death and disability in the developing world. And also for most of that part of the world, rice is a staple crop. Rice is a staple crop for half of the world, for 50%. In Bangladesh, rice is responsible for between 30 and 70% of people's calories. Can you imagine getting 70% of your caloric intake from rice?
Yeah,
so
boy.
The idea is we take a staple crop that people are eating a lot of. We fortify it with vitamin A, and that goes a long way to reducing vitamin A deficiency. We save poor kids from going blind and dying from vitamin
A
deficiency. Makes sense, right? Who could be against that? Who could possibly be against that? Well, the anti-GMO crowd is against it.
What?
How could they possibly be against that? That's the point of this item. So they're against it because they're panicking that it's going to give GMOs a win, and we can't. Have that, can we?
Goodness forbid.
So what are their talking points against golden rice? Well, they can't say it's about pesticides because it's not. They can't say it's patented because it's not. They can't say evil corporations are going to make money from selling it because it's being made available for free. It's not about profits. It's all about – they're giving it away to free to poor farmers so they could just have vitamin A fortified rice. So it breaks –
So what are they saying? It's going to turn the kids
narrative.
Into mutants?
Well, so they do say that it's potentially unsafe. Of course, it isn't unsafe. So the golden rice has been approved in America, Canada, and Australia. It's never going to be grown in any of those three countries. But the approval was not because we need it, because we don't need it in these countries.
Legitimacy.
It was just to help, you know, other countries like Bangladesh ride our coattails. If the FDA goes through the process of evaluating it, vetting it, showing that it's safe, showing that it's effective, and then they approve it, then Bangladesh could say, okay, if the FDA approved it and Canada approved it and Australia approved it, I guess it's okay. It's good enough for us. So it's just to help the other countries of the world to approve it and to use it. So what they're saying is that, and here's the title of an anti-GMO article about golden rice. Beware the GMO trap. Golden rice release in Bangladesh, a marketing tool for GMOs.
Right. So it's the thin wedge. Right.
Yeah, they're basically saying they're doing this. They're going to save blind kids from dying as a way of promoting GMOs, and we have to stop them. We can't let them do that. Like, those bastards. They're going to
– Oh, yeah.
It's like that's literally their argument, that saving poor kids from going blind and dying is an evil plot to make it look good. They're going to make it look good because it is good, because it's working. And they're so that sticks in their craw so much they would rather condemn poor kids to going blind and dying rather than just accepting that maybe there could, you know, be a positive use for genetic modification. Unbelievable.
Pathetic.
They also tell a number. So of course they have nothing legitimate to say. So they basically just lie. Seriously, they just straight up lie.
No, that's easy.
Yeah. So here's the big one. Here's the big one. They say that it doesn't work, doesn't have enough vitamin A in it to work. So one anti-Golden Rights article writes, many of them, this is again, these are very, very, these are the most common talking points that I encountered. One of them says, in its 2018 approval, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration concluded that, quote, the level of beta-carotene in golden rice is too low to warrant a nutrient content claim. So most of the articles say things like the FDA says that golden rice doesn't work, that golden rice has insufficient vitamin A levels, that it's not fortified with vitamin A, that it won't, whatever, that it basically won't work. That's not what the FDA says. So that is a deliberate deception. In the United States, here's what they're, this is a deception by omission and by implication, by false implication. And sometimes they do, they parlay that into a direct lie. But in order for a food to be designated as being quote unquote fortified with a specific vitamin, it has to include enough of that specific vitamin so that it will meet the RDA with typical American consumption. But
oh, there's the rub.
That in typical Southeast Asians eat 25 times the amount of rice as a typical American.
Right. So we don't want to OD them on vitamin A. Sorry.
Right. So yes, it won't be, it will be an insignificant amount for an American diet, but a huge amount for a Southeast Asian diet, for a Bangladeshi diet. And so that's just a lie. And in fact, it's been tested and it produces like 60% of what they might need in terms of vitamin A, of their daily amount. That would go a massive way to reduce vitamin A deficiency. And all they have to do is just keep doing what they're doing. You know what I mean? So that's one lie, that it won't work. And that's their favorite bit of deception now. Another lie is that it's not needed, that we don't need. Well, how could you say it's not needed? So get this again. And then if you read the comments, people are buying this. This is, again, this is one of the very few talking points you will encounter over and over again. Farmers from the Philippines, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, and other rice-growing countries are in solidarity with the Bangladesh farmers on rejecting the commercialization plan of golden rice. Poverty and genuine development must be addressed to ensure that the people have access to diversified, safe, and healthy food and sustainable livelihood. We must resist golden rice together as a global community to assert our food sovereignty.
Wow.
So
what the hell is that?
Yeah, so what they're saying is that the underlying problem, the reason why we have vitamin A deficiency, is because of poverty and because of food insecurity. And so we don't need golden rice to solve vitamin A deficiency. All we need to do is, one, fix poverty. Two, we need to replace a staple crop with other foods. And we need to replace the calories from that staple crop with other foods that have vitamin A in it. And that we have to change the farming and eating habits of half the world that they've had for centuries. That's all.
What planet are these people living on?
Wow. What an amazing argument.
That's their argument.
That's all.
Wow.
Yeah, that's because, right, adding vitamin A to golden rice, that won't work. But basically reshape the entire world.
Right. And it's not as if we're saying we don't want to fix poverty, right? Sure, plant sweet potatoes, plant carrots. Go right ahead. They're already doing that.
It's like a false dichotomy.
We're already distributing multivitamins and vitamins. We're already doing all those other things. It's just not enough. It's not stopping the problem. This is one more thing that we're doing that will make a huge, huge impact for nothing, for free. We're just giving them the seeds.
For nothing.
But that's amazing that's the logic that there's. And people are buying it. We talked, I think, previously about the fact that somebody in a back room comes up with a ridiculous, you know, talking point, and then the hordes on the internet are repeating it as if it's their idea without really thinking it through. Just amazing. And then they say, oh, people are against it. Well, they're against it because you're lying to them about it and you're scaring them about it. So then you can't use that as a reason to justify being against it. You know, when you lied about it in the first place, it is amazing. We do have to keep the pressure on to get golden rice to farmers in Bangladesh to have them grow it. The anti-GMO people, the organic food lobby, you know, the whole thing are panicking and are pulling out all the stops in their misinformation campaign against Golden Rice, because seriously, they would rather condemn millions of children to blindness than to risk the trap of a GMO that actually works and doesn't fit their fear-mongering narrative. Yep. Absolutely amazing.
And therefore, that's why parts of this world are ugly places. Seriously.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the reasons.
For people to be able to compartmentalize that type of thinking, you know, to put away the logic completely and to not be able to just, you know what? Sometimes, guys, we're wrong. Sometimes things we want to believe in are wrong. Sometimes things, conclusions that we've come to on our own that we're proud of, our precious thoughts, are wrong. We have to get over ourselves. You know, a lot of people accuse us of being the closed-minded people, being the ones that, you know, are following a dogma, a strict dogma and all that. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. I can change my mind on a dime with new scientific information. And you know what? It happens all the time. And I've gotten to the point where I don't even care. I just want to know what the truth is. I just want to know what the closest thing to what the truth is. And that is one of the beautiful goals and rewards you get as a skeptic and a critical thinker is you divorce yourself of caring about what the truth is for the most part. You know, I'm not going to say it's 100%, but it's damn close because I've really had things that I've thought my whole life were true. I actually enjoy that feeling when it gets corrected.
Yeah, because you think, oh, God, I was walking around with that bit of misinformation or that misconception. Well, now that's fixed now. So it is good. Like, yeah, spider silk is not as strong as steel.
Yep.
What?
See, what's funny is I was happy to know the truth, but I was pissed that I got it wrong and that
for
news got it wrong. Yeah. TV shows, everybody got that wrong. Like the world had it wrong.
Yeah. Really? Like chameleons don't use their color changing ability for camouflage? Really?
No, but Steve, the move deeper, like that spider silk one was very impactful for me because it taught me the differences in strength. That was one of the few times on the show we talked about the different kinds of strength,
right?
You know, and it was fascinating. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, I've forgotten, I think, a lot of the details and I want to revisit it because I would like to, you know, remember like the different kinds and be able to communicate it because I, you know, it's something that comes up, to be honest with you. It really does come up from time to time.
Right. But it also does reinforce, and this will come up again in our interview later, how I think the baseline job that journalists do on science is so poor because they have a limited set of narratives. And it's the same thing with the anti-GMO thing. It's a narrative. People are following this very specific black and white narrative, and they're not looking at everything case by case and the actual logic and the actual evidence. And if you're dedicated to one side, to one tribe and the narrative that supports that tribe, then you will say really stupid shit. Like, we can't have any of this golden rice. We have to fix poverty. That's the only way to fix this problem and change farming practices for half the world. You know, that's the simpler solution. I mean, it's like really ridiculous things.
Yep.
It's the horrors of pathological thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. But Jay, our artificial intelligence is going to save us from all of this, right?
I mean, someday it's going to save us. It's already actually saving us from some stuff. So they ask the question, how intelligent is artificial intelligence? And it's not just as simple as that question. It is, how do we measure the intelligence of artificial intelligence? Well, you know what? We couldn't do this not that long ago. Like not that long ago, meaning like maybe a year ago, we couldn't do it. So, you know, modern society, as you know, we're becoming more and more dependent on artificial intelligence. We call them intelligent learning algorithms. You know, applications like Alexa and Google Home, you know, these are in millions of households. You know, in the near future, autonomous driving will be ubiquitous and largely run by AI. I mean, if not 100% run by AI. In the past few years, we've seen this dramatic increase in AI capabilities. But the question here is, how do we understand what the AI is doing? And how do we come to a reasonable conclusion about how intelligent the AI is? AI is using an algorithm, which is a series of logic gates, and they're very complicated. And a lot of times they're running in tandem with other ones all happening at the same time that are analyzing data and then trying to come up with an answer, right? So the basic question could be something like this. You're talking to Alexa.
Alexa takes your recorded voice and sends it back to a server at Amazon, and it runs through an AI algorithm. The AI algorithm matches your speech pattern to the sentence that you said to it with the keyword Alexa to turn it on or to initiate the search. And it matches it, it pattern matches it with millions of words and phrases and sentences. It's just taking the words that you've told it, and it's comparing it to its database. And then it comes up very accurately most of the time with the thing that you're asking. You know, Alexa, what's the time? Alexa, what's the weather going to be tomorrow? You know, those are two very different questions to ask, and the software has to figure it out. So researchers from TU Berlin, Fraunhofer, Heinrich Hertz Institute, HHI, and Singapore University of Technology and Design have come up with the answer to all of these questions that I've put on the table. Monitoring AI and how it functions has become increasingly more important. Why? Because it allows us to see paths of decision-making. When I say paths, it's exactly what I just described with Alexa figuring out what you said. It has to go through all of these things in order to get to the answer, and it has to happen really fast, and it has to be super accurate. What the research team has developed allows them to identify and quantify these complicated decision trees and detect error-prone patterns.
Wow.
Because of these new monitoring systems that have been developed, researchers and software developers can put an AI system through a battery of tests and end up with significantly useful results. So there are categories of an AI system's abilities. Now, here's one of the things I didn't know before. For example, an AI can have something called naive problem-solving behavior, which I'm going to go into detail to explain to you. They can also have something called cheating strategies. And they can also have something called intelligent strategic solutions. So the first two are really not that good. They can get some jobs done. You know, the naive behavior and the cheating strategies. They cheating doesn't necessarily mean bad. It just means not truly operating as an artificial intelligence.
And so the quick and dirty, probably, right? The quick and dirty, you want to get it done fast.
Right. And I'm going to give you some great examples. And I had to go through all this rigmarole to explain the background so you can understand what's coming next. But keep in mind, I'm also talking about the thing I just said, intelligent strategic solutions. That's real AI. So a cool example of this is something called a Clever Hans strategy. We know what the Clever Hans is, right? So for those of you who don't, the Clever Hans concept is that there was a horse named Hans, and the horse could do math. So what people would do is they would put a math problem to the horse, 4 + 2, and the horse would tap its foot, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and the horse would keep tapping its foot until its trainer very subtly told it to stop tapping, and no one noticed the trainer giving it this little signal, and the horse could do math problems completely to the degree that its trainer could do, because the trainer was telling him when to stop. So,
but actually, just to clarify, Jay,
inadvertent.
Yeah, the trainer was doing it subconsciously. He wasn't aware of it. And in fact, the trainer didn't have to be present. The horse could pick up clues from anyone who knew the answer. The only made the effect go away when nobody in the room knew the answer to the question.
Boy, that horse is pretty damn clever.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So this Clever Hans idea, this would be a strategy that a naive problem-solving system would use. So for example, if an AI program was searching through pictures, it would use the context of the pictures to make a conclusion about what's in the picture. So let me explain what I just said. If the picture had water in it, they would assume that the picture had a boat in it as well. And they would label or categorize that picture as a picture that has a boat. And if the picture had railroad tracks in it, they would assume that there was a train in the picture as well. And you know what? These AI softwares that do this, they can get like 90% accuracy off of pictures, because it's weird. But, you know, they have all these cheats that they can use to shortcut this process. And it's not They're heuristics, and they're not that inaccurate. 90% accuracy is pretty damn good. And I guess that's fine if you're looking for ships and trains and pictures. You know, what's at stake here? But the researchers found things like the Clever Hans strategy, even in state-of-the-art AI algorithms. Not good. Now, you wouldn't want an AI system using a naive strategy like this if it was helping your doctor come up with a diagnosis, right? Or especially if the freaking thing was driving your car. Oh, there's a a stop sign there. So that stop sign, there's got to be a person standing near the stop sign. Well, there's nobody standing there or whatever. You know, I'm just coming up with an idea of what crazy decision that the AI in a driverless car can make. We want it to be 100% accurate, 100% accurate, or as damn close as we can get to 100% accuracy. On the flip side of that, because that's an example of, you know, what could go wrong if you're using these naive systems to do really important stuff. But there's also researchers also discovered AI systems that had learned unexpectedly smart strategies. So a cool example of this was an AI system that learned how to play the Atari game Breakout and another game called Pinball. Now, what this diagnostic software was able to conclude was that the AI absolutely understood the concept of how to play the game. And it actually found very intelligent ways to earn points in the game that were low risk, meaning not losing lives or not losing the game. In the same example, they also found that the software developed strategies that a human player would never have thought of, which I think is really fascinating, right? So this AI software came up with movements and things that a typical human being just wouldn't do. And it was beneficial to winning the game. So, you know, the software that the researchers created, to give you a quickie summary, they made the software first open source so anyone can use it, which I think is wonderful. You know, open source means anybody, any other scientist will gain access to it and be able to edit it and do what they want with it. Because they see it as a hugely important step in making modern AI systems more powerful, secure, understandable, and as fail-safe as possible. The software that these researchers developed was able to do a deep monitoring of the way that the AI goes through its entire tree network of rigmarole and all of its decisions and come up with really insightful, useful ways to determine if the AI was going down healthy paths or non-healthy paths. Or a better way to put that would be, intelligent pathways that make good decisions versus using bad shortcuts or making really bad decisions, even though all the data is there and the AI is trying to do it. They could fail-safe it and say, hey, look, this part isn't functioning correctly. Let's fix it. Let's beef it up. Or reprogram it to make it work better. So it's a view into the way AI works. And guys, we really didn't have a clear view into how it works because AI isn't, like I said, it isn't a linear type of programming. It does all sorts of stuff. There's a lot of trial and error with AI. And I'm not taking away any of the intensity and knowledge and gravitas of these software developers that create AI. Like, they know what their AI is supposed to do. But I guess there's a difference between the programming part of it, and then when you run it, and the practical part of it can be quite different than what's expected. And there's a lot of trial and error. Well, this software shines a bright light on the entire thing and gives them like much clearer pictures on what's going on. So, wow, researchers, thank you. That's super impressive what they pulled off here. And the fact that they made it open source, the fact that it's going to be a huge enhancement to AI, you know, it's going to take time for them to develop. You know, they don't just turn this software on. They have to like tweak it to make it work for each thing. But it gives you a way to bug test artificial intelligence.
Yeah. So this is going to help us write better AI software, basically.
Yep. That's right, Steve.
Don't kill people.
So that's going to just bring it closer, the year closer where AIs take over the world.
But doesn't it blow your mind though? Like that example I gave you, like they were doing this thing, like a software developer decided that we're going to have our AI. If there's water in the picture, there's a boat in the picture. Just because 90% of the time there's a boat in the picture. So there's your boat, because it was easier to find for the AI to find water because of, I guess, the way that the pixel patterns end up than it was for it to find a quote unquote boat, which could be thousands of different things. You know what I mean? Boats come in all shapes and sizes. That's kind of scary.
And what's funny is, I mean, that's literally a heuristic.
Yeah.
So it always fascinates me when our technology recapitulates our brain, right? Or what happened in evolution. Because, hundreds of millions of years of trial and error, turns out, hit upon some good solutions. And now we're replicating those solutions. Like, quick, down, and dirty rules that are right 95% of the time, that's okay for certain applications.
Yeah. Not for driverless
so
cars, and not in the doctor's office.
Right.
And this is one of those times, like, I'd really encourage anybody that programs AI that has a clearer picture on this. Man, we'd love to hear from you because we're all fascinated about this, and I would love to have a deeper, better understanding. It's very hard to really understand it. I've never programmed artificial intelligence, and I know that when you're a programmer of something, you have such a deep you know, intimate understanding of it in a way that general public people like me at this point, I hate to say that, but I'm really not a software developer anymore. And I'm certainly not at the point where I feel like I have my head wrapped around artificial intelligence. I really want to talk to someone about this. I'd love to interview someone about this and hear the inside on what's going on.
We'll find someone. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, KiwiCo.
Hey, everybody. KiwiCo creates super cool hands-on projects for kids that make learning about STEAM fun. So if you get a KiwiCo subscription each month, you're going to get a package in the mail for the kid or more than one kid in your life. And they're going to receive like an engaging project that's hands-on that you can help them build or develop, you know, depending on what the project is. This will help inspire creativity and confidence. And let me tell you, we've all used them now. Like Steve, Evan, mm-hmm. and I all have kids. We've all used different projects of theirs. And they are just as much fun for me as they are for my kids. And, the thing is, it's something to look forward to. It's a great, awesome birthday present. It's an awesome Christmas present for your kids or for your friends' kids.
Yeah, every one I've done with my daughter has been great. And she basically just does them on her own, too. They're completely accessible. They're age specific. The instructions are great. And every time they do it, they learn something about science.
And you don't need anything else that's not in the box. The box has everything you need.
KiwiCo is offering the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe listeners the chance to try them for free. To redeem this offer and learn more, visit kiwico.com/skeptics. That's KIWICO.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Bob, tell us about the new atomic clocks.
Boom.
All right. So scientists have made a dramatic advance with optical atomic clocks that could hopefully lead one day to these hyper-accurate clocks in our pockets, which would actually minimize or perhaps even remove our need entirely of GPS satellites, which was an interesting little hook that got me into reading more about this and how would that work? So this is from scientists in Emergent Photonics Lab. At the University of Sussex, and they recently published in the journal Nature Photonics. So GPS, I mean, we've all heard that initialism over and over. It's one of those awesome technologies that we totally take for granted, right? I mean, can you imagine not using GPS? It's just so embedded into our lives. Can you imagine going back to printing out driving instructions from MapQuest again?
or using actual maps?
God forbid, read paper maps. My God, I would just like kill myself. I would just like drive off the road because I'd be looking at the stupid map. Here, this is the point where I will insert a really cool GPS fact for you. Did you know GPS, Global Positioning System, did you know that your GPS unit will shut down if it realizes it's traveling faster than 1,900 kilometers per hour? At an altitude higher than 18,000 meters.
Why, Bob?
There's lots of that
because
happening.
It does that in case it's being used for something nefarious like an intercontinental ballistic missile.
Wow.
It's like, I'm traveling way too fast and I'm going way too high. I'm just going to shut down right now so I'm not used as an explosive, you know, on explosive device. I thought that was just such an interesting little fact.
It was originally developed by the armed services. So you would think that, that would make sense that they would put those kinds of safeguards into a system like that.
Yeah, but also they probably have GPS units, you know, GPS systems that actually were intended for that to happen as well. So life would be obviously more annoying for average people if we didn't have those I think there's 31 satellites in orbit. We need 24. They've got some extras here and there. But you don't even think about it or even know, for example, that those satellites depend on the mind-numbing accuracy of their onboard atomic clocks, right? You don't really think necessarily that, these are good for navigation, but it also needs unbelievably accurate atomic clocks there. And I mean, we're talking about an accuracy that's something like less than 1 second in 10 billion years. So think about that. So if you're born and you look at a clock and then you live a century and you look at that clock again, you know, if you can kind of imagine that, that clock will have lost only 0.00001 seconds, 10 millionth of a second in a century.
Time to
in
correct
a century.
For that.
They're just really incredible, and you think, oh, that's a little bit of overkill, isn't it? Well, actually, no. Clocks that accurate are critical because if the timing is off, even by microseconds, it won't know where you are. And of course, it's all Einstein's fault, right? Damn his genius. He showed that relative velocities and positions in a gravitational field will speed or slow down your clock relative to other frames of reference. I got to throw that.
Wait, so you're saying that GPS works by a principle of time and relative dimension in space?
No, I'm not saying that because we're not time traveling. But so this is so what we are talking about, Steve, is relativistic and gravitational time dilation.
Yes, and that's what I said.
And I just love that shit. So this what I'm saying is the speedy satellites are moving fast relative to us. So their clocks are slower by actually seven or eight microseconds per day compared to the same clock on the ground. So, but on the other hand, gravity is stronger on the Earth than in orbit. And that means space-time is curved more for us. So the clocks in orbit run 45 microseconds faster each day. So essentially, the satellite's speed slows their clock a little, but their distance from the Earth speeds them up by a greater amount. So if you kind of do that sum, the net-net then is that the GPS satellites gain 38 microseconds per day compared to an identical clock on the Earth. That's the bottom line. And that's all because of special and general relativity right there. So, and this is not a minor issue. If we could somehow beam those satellites into space and, you know, immediately, they would become unacceptably wrong after only about 2 minutes if they didn't account for these relativistic effects. Each day that they went, that they did their thing, they'd be off by an additional 10 kilometers. So it very quickly would be immensely useless. So basically what I'm saying here is that they really need these hyper-accurate clocks on these satellites. So GPS, yeah, GPS is nice and all, but come on, we've all cursed it at times, right? Haven't we? Right? Admit it. I've cursed out GPS many times when you go in a tunnel and it thinks that you're on the moon. Like, wait, I'm not here. What the hell's going on? When it thinks, how about this one? This one's a good one. When it thinks you're on the highway that's right next to you, not the one that you're on, but the one that's right next to you, or sure, even worse, how about
underneath
it thinks,
you?
It thinks, yeah, it thinks it's above you or below you. That really pisses me off. And here's one that I bet you never considered. How about if you're a country that doesn't want to depend on another country for critical GPS applications? So what are you going to do? What can we do about it? How do you fix that? Well, you don't need to put your own GPS satellites in space. How about if you carry your own optical atomic clock with you in your back pocket? That would essentially solve that problem in a lot of ways. So here's a quote. Dr. Alessia Pasquazi from the EPIC lab I described earlier in my talk in the School of Mathematical and Physical Sciences at the University of Sussex. She said, with a portable atomic clock, an ambulance, for example, will be able to still access their mapping whilst in a tunnel, and a commuter will be able to plan their route whilst on the underground or without mobile phone signals in the countryside. Portable atomic clocks would work on an extremely accurate form of geo-mapping, enabling access to your location and planned route without the need for satellite signals. So that's really cool. It's amazing to think that you can get around incredibly accurately without having these GPS satellites orbiting above you.
Atomic clocks are big.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Good timing, Evan, because these atomic clocks weigh, the clocks themselves can weigh hundreds of kilograms. So that would be one smart heavy phone, one heavy smartphone. This is nothing that is portable, not even close to being portable now. So scientists have been trying to reduce the weight of these clocks for years, and these Sussex researchers have essentially done a lot of that work. This is the crux of their breakthrough, and it's all due to how optical atomic clocks work. So they keep time by looking at the frequency of light emitted by a specific atom. It's kind of like that quantum value, that number is kind of like the pendulum of a clock, right? So the device that measures this frequency from the atom is called a comb. A frequency comb is what it's often described as. So the word comb is very apt because if you think about a laser beam that's made up of a series of equally spaced colors or frequencies of light. And if you plot those frequencies, it actually looks like a comb. So that's what this laser light's looked at. So this component of the atomic clock, this frequency comb, is one of the biggest and heaviest parts. So what the Sussex researchers did was to shrink this comb by incorporating it into a tiny chip. So this is called a microcomb. And actually, from what I could tell, microcomb itself was not brand new. The breakthrough, though, is that it's exceptionally efficient and hardy, something that can be put onto, say, a satellite. or something that can be part of a system of a GPS that's really, really small, and an atomic clock that's really, really small. So this is something that scientists have been dreaming about for a decade once they came up with this idea of microcombs and really taking advantage of what these frequency combs can do and the applications that they want to use, but they haven't been able to do because it's just not small enough. It's not portable enough. So they've been really thinking about this. And this team, and I give them lots of kudos here, this is a major step towards eventually creating a pocket atomic clock that can be used for this intensely accurate geomapping, and kind of doing away with a lot of the functions that we use GPS for today. So in the future, I mean, this is something that could take 20 years before you actually will see something in the store that you could buy, and hopefully it'll come even quicker. But I like how they're not saying, well, maybe it'll happen in 5 to 8 years. No, they're saying that the researchers are saying, yeah, it could happen probably within 20 years, and it'll be used for driverless cars. I mean, imagine how popular driverless cars are going to be in 20 years. Drones? Who the hell knows where drones are going to be in 20 years? But I'm sure they're going to take use of this. I mean, imagine not having to do satellite surveying of the surface of the Earth. I mean, you've heard, we've done stories about using satellites to survey because you could be very, very accurate using the GPS of exactly what you're surveying. Imagine if you can survey with this hyper accuracy using a drone or just somebody in a car. I mean, that'd be incredible because you wouldn't need to spend millions of dollars on these satellites in order to do that. So keep your eyes out for the optical atomic clocks. In the future, you might just find one in your coat pocket.
Cool.
Nice.
Yeah, that does sound like a technology game changer.
You know, yeah,
having
yeah.
a pocket atomic clock. And I think we're just scratching the surface in terms of the potential applications. It's one of those things like, yeah, we
yeah,
think
usual.
About, yeah, we're going to develop it for this application, but actually it's the other applications that are going to be the real game changer, you know?
Right. It's so hard to predict, so hard to predict. But yeah. even if there's no other surprising, like, holy crap, new applications, it would still be just from what we know we could use it for right now. We know it could be a game changers in a lot of different ways. But yeah, you're right. Who knows what we'll be doing with this stuff?
Cool. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Guys, last week I played this noisy. All right, so Philip Starner wrote in and said, this sound reminds me of the first time I opened the player piano I learned to play when I was 7 years old. I was surprised to find out that my music teacher was right. The piano is a percussion instrument. The noisy might sound like what the hammers on the piano strings would sound like if they were slowed down in time. Wow, Phil, that's quite an origin of the noisy. That is incorrect.
Hmm.
And I will add right now that many people guessed a large body of ice calving or, you know, shearing off of and falling down in some manner or other, because I got lots of variations on it. This has nothing to do with ice. But thank you for sending in those guesses, everyone. This other listener named Paul said, hi, Jay, after listening for a decade, this is my first guess. So thanks for listening for 10 years, Paul. Thank you very much. The sound is a train stopping. Now, this one's pretty cool. Listen to what he thought it was. More specifically, the slaps that each train car makes as they slam into the one in front. And since trains are often really long, the sound has the Doppler-like effect. That's pretty cool. I've been on trains, and I know exactly what he's talking about. When a train is slowing down or stopping, there's a little give in between the way that the trains hook together. And sometimes you could feel like the compression happen as the train slows down. And not correct, but that was a cool guess. There is a winner. And this week,
yeah.
Steve just gets so excited. Cameron Fleming said, hey guys, first time responding to noisy. I think I saw this earlier in the week. I believe it is a balloon being popped inside an old nuclear silo or similar structure and hearing the reverb and slapback delay go on for ages.
Cool.
Correct
Whoa.
Answer.
Wow.
Because I care about my Who's That Noisy listeners, I will play it again.
Ooh. Yeah, neat.
Uh-huh.
You can almost visualize it when you know
yeah.
That's
what it is.
Boss.
Right? That is really cool. Thank you, Matt, for sending that in, and thanks, Cameron, for guessing correctly. I have a new noisy this week. This noisy was sent in by a listener named Joe Hansey. What is that noisy?
What was
now,
that?
My guess is that a very large portion of our audience will have absolutely no idea what it is, and a very large portion of our audience will know exactly what that noise is. So do it. Send it in. What do you think it was? And if you heard anything really cool this week, I mean, come on. You guys are living lives all over the world. Like, you have to hear something cool. You know you heard something cool last week, and you should feel mildly guilty you didn't send it in to me. Send it in this week to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, thanks, Jay. We have a couple of quick questions because we need to save time for the interview. First one comes from Nick, C-E-J-D-A. What do you think? Sedja?
Good enough. Sure.
Whatever. Nick. Nick writes, I was browsing Audible's library and was surprised to discover your audiobook was released. Will you be doing an announcement on the podcast? If you already did, I just must have missed it, perhaps due to my filtered perception of reality. I'm sure lots of your podcast listeners would enjoy the audiobook version, but like me, they might not know it is out. So far, I'm really enjoying the book, already recommending it to colleagues and friends. Best, Nick. Well, yes, Nick, our audiobook is now available on Audible. It was, in fact, last October.
Mm-hmm.
They launched the ebook, the hardcover of the book, and the audiobook all at the same time in October 2018. This is, of course, the eponymous book of the podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This is our tome of critical thinking and scientific literacy. I did record myself the audiobook version. If you prefer to listen to books than to read them, that is available from Audible's library. So check it out.
What does SGU have to do with hippopotamuses?
Eponymous.
Oh, eponymous. I get it.
The book covers all of the stuff we talk about on the show. It goes over like all the logical fallacies, cognitive biases, all the heuristics, the problems with our perception, our constructed nature of reality, how to talk with your family about crazy stuff, journalism, everything, all the stuff that we go over. It sort of walks us through it. I love the section on adventures and skepticism, where we tell stories about how we struggled with some topic. So if you haven't read the book yet, I do suggest that you check it out. And as Nick did, recommend it to colleagues and friends and acquaintances and strangers on the bus. Why not?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. This next email comes from Owen Martin. And we're reading this one because I think this guy gets the pedantic email of the year. But it was kind of fun. So I thought we would cover it on the show very quickly. Owen writes, hey guys and gal, I apologize for the length of this email, but I think it's something you may find interesting. I usually try not to correct things like this so as to avoid being the well actually guy, but on the latest episode during Bob's bit about mice and infrared vision, he said how people were, quote, chomping at the bit a couple of times. Almost everyone says this expression incorrectly. It's supposed to be champing at the bit, not chomping. The bit is the part of the apparatus a jockey or rider uses to control and direct horses. It fits into the toothless ridge in the back of a horse's mouth and connects to the bridle and reins. The idiom originates from racehorses grinding or champing their teeth against, not on, the bit from excitement or nervousness. Furthermore, the word chomp is a transitive verb, meaning it requires an object for it to make sense, i.e. the horse would need something to chomp on. The horse does not actually bite down on the bit, so chomping is not accurate. And even if it were, the horse would chomp on the bit, not at it. Call me a purist or pedantic, but I thought you might find this interesting. Keep up the great work, Rogues. I really hope I can meet you all one day. Thanks so much, Owen. Yeah, this is almost like our what's the word kind of segment here, the etymology of champing at the bit. I actually love phrases like this.
Idioms are wonderful. So much fun.
My mother-in-law has a book in her house that's just like the etymology of idioms. And it's crazy how they come about. And what's interesting is that they always tend to lose their original meaning. And like people don't know what the original meaning or source was. It just means whatever the new thing is that it's being used as. And then it evolves towards the new use. So it's kind of like adaptive evolution, adaptive radiation. So like people say, oh, he's a loose cannon. And without necessarily, or the whole nine yards. What's the origin of the whole nine yards?
I'm not sure we're positive about that one, but.
One fell swoop, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What does all that mean? Or dead as a doorknob. Why are people always dead as a doorknob? In this case, champing has a very specific meaning that makes sense. But I think this is one of those hopeless causes. You're never going to correct people from saying chomping. Mm-hmm. And as Kara pointed out when we were having an email exchange on this, you can actually can pronounce C-H-A-M-P-I-N-G as chomping. So if you say chomping, you could be correct as long as you're spelling it champing. Does that make sense?
Sure.
But I think that you know, people are saying chomping at the bit. This doesn't matter if it makes literal sense or not. It's a saying. It means what it means. That's what people say. And it's basically a hopeless cause.
It evolved.
It's like, don't bother correcting people when they say...
Irregardless?
No, irregardless is just wrong. It's regardless.
Damn it.
There is no irregardless.
I was trying to sneak that through.
No. I was thinking of that begs the question.
Oh, yeah.
People use that incorrectly. But whatever. It means to raise the question. That's right. What it means now. That's how people use it. But yeah, it is actually.
Right.
Or when people say the proof is in the pudding.
In the pudding.
No, the proof of the pudding is in the tasting. Make sense?
Yes. Oh, my God. That's a great one.
But it's funny that it doesn't even make literal sense anymore. But that's how people use it.
But that's what idioms do. They don't make literal sense.
You can't think of them, though. You just have to let them become what they are.
And so, Steve, in your research, I came across the fact that 20 times more people say chomping rather than champing.
Lost cause.
And that just points to the idea of but languages are living things and they change. And sometimes it's hard to accept that fact. But it's interesting to see this evolution.
Is there one in particular that bothers you? Here's the one that I wish people would use correctly. When people say, I could care less.
Yes.
No, you couldn't care less.
Right. Because
it makes no sense to say you could care less.
I'm not even sure that qualifies as an idiom because it's perfectly logical, you know? Yeah, there's nothing mysterious about it.
But it has evolved into an idiom as I could care less. That's the idiom now. Even though it doesn't make any literal sense. But here, what we're seeing here, if you may have noticed a trend in a lot of these idioms, is that they get shortened over time. That's one of the features.
Right. That's just a psychological thing.
The proof of the pudding is in the tasting to the proof is in the pudding.
And right.
So, because it's shorter, even though now it no longer makes literal sense.
That's just humans being humans.
Sure. Yeah. We're ants. We're ants following, cutting the corners until we're in a straight line. And we talked about another one that stuck with me because I knew it wrong my whole life. It was blood is thicker than water.
Mm-hmm.
When it actually means the opposite of what it originally meant, right? It was originally the blood of the covenant is thicker than the water of the womb, meaning that an Holy ideological crap. Connection is stronger than a relative connection. But now people use it to mean the exact opposite. They to say that a family connection is stronger than other connections.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And I like the original better.
Right.
Right? It's more poignant.
But it's more poetic. It's longer, though.
Right.
Yeah.
That's it. Got to be pithy.
Over time, things become shorter, pithier, but less literally true. That's just the way it is.
It's all right. More convenient.
Okay. But thanks, Owen. It was an interesting discussion.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about a new sponsor this week, the Rochester Institute of Technology, RIT.
Yeah, RIT is a private doctoral university. They have 9 academic colleges, including a lot of creative and STEM, and they're widely known for their fine arts, computing, and imaging science, and they have the National Technical Institute for the Deaf.
Get this, guys. The team at RIT replicated the powerful yet simple muscle movements of a trout using an elastomeric material, which is basically a super strong stretchy fiber that carries an electric charge to create a fully submersible robot fish. They did it in the hopes that this could lead to a new wave of prosthetics that help amputees regain fine motor skills.
Cool.
That's cool.
The team of creative engineering students is using design thinking and innovative technology to prove that at RIT, they're onto something life-changing. Learn more about the project at rit.edu/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, we're going to go on with our interview. This will be released uncut as a 50 or so minute premium content. So for those of you who want to listen to the whole interview, we're going to have about a 15-20 minute excerpt from the interview in the show. But I know some people request to be warned when a longer interview is available as premium content so they can just go to that. So let's go to that interview now. Joining us now is Peter DeJager. Peter, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you very, very much for having me on.
And Peter, you are a Y2K expert, and in fact, you say that you are the first person to write about Y2K in such a way as to make it a thing, to get worldwide attention about it. Is that right?
Yeah, I was going to correct you. I wasn't the first. I mean, there have been IBM scientists who wrote about this back in, well, as early as late 1960s. There were other people who had written articles about it over that next decade. And then in 1993, in the beginning of the year, I wrote a small article that got no attention. And then in the end of 1993, September, the Computer World magazine, which had a circulation of about 350,000 people in the States, published an article that they gave the title to of Doomsday 2000. Mm-hmm. And it was that one that kicked off the frou-frou.
The Y2K thing.
Yeah, it wasn't called Y2K at that point. It was just called the date rollover problem.
Yeah, or the millennium bug hit at some point. Yeah, I think it's true. I think I remember that Y2K was sort of a later thing, but it was very it was a good initialism. Yeah, it was very pithy. And so that stuck once it hit, the Y2K bug.
Peter, I'm sure you've been asked this question before, but I've never actually heard a reasonable answer to what if we didn't do anything to prepare for Y2K?
Well, but and before you answer that, give our audience a quick overview of what the Y2K bug was.
Y2K bug is incredibly simple to describe. When you fire up a computer in the olden days, you would type in the year with two digits. So you would type in 76, and the computer would assume that was 1976. If you typed in 99, it would assume it was 1999. But when you typed in 00, the computer, as we programmed it, would assume it was 1900. Mm-hmm. Now, by itself, that doesn't mean much. But then you start figuring out, well, how does it calculate how old you are? It subtracts your birth year from the current year. So in 1999, I was born in 55. I was 44 years old. When it goes to 00, it goes 00, since that's the current year, you typed it in, minus 55, Peter DeJager is minus 55 years old.
Mm-hmm. You solved the aging problem. Well done.
It does that and a whole bunch of other little subsidiary problems, but that's fundamentally it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you're a programmer and you can see a line of code that's doing that, you can fix that in a couple of seconds. One problem. We have billions of lines of code, and we don't know where the problem is or if it is in every program that you rely on.
Mm-hmm. Was there any consensus as to why they used two digits? I had always heard that because of the space requirements of like punch cards, old punch cards, that they had to use – they used two numbers instead of wasting, you know, the space on the old punch cards. Is that kind of the consensus view, or is it really just lots of different reasons?
No, that's pretty much it. Back in the day, using two digits to refer to the year made sense in the same way that we use codes like BOS for Boston Airport. We use a code for the airport. We don't use the full name of the airport. That would be silly. So we have a code and we do a lookup. Well, the same sort of thing on the Hollerith cards, which were the 80-character cards. There is a problem with that explanation, though, because then I'm going to ask, why are we using two-digit years today? Because we all have all the space we need. But on your receipts and on your computers, when you're typing stuff in, we're back to using two-digit years.
Well, because we have another 80 years.
The next generation has somebody else's problem, right?
Yeah, I'm going to take you out behind the barn for a second.
All right, so before we forget, though, I want to hear the answer. What if we didn't do anything, or what if we didn't do enough to fix the year issue with Y2K?
Then programs would have given incorrect results. Mm-hmm. Now you're going to say, well, what's the consequence of that?
Right. Yes.
And the honest answer is, I have no idea.
Right.
See, I do not know in advance, nor do you or anybody else, you do not know in advance how an error is going to result in a problem. Well, let me give you one or two examples from history, okay? Therac 25. This was a radiology device, a radioactive mm-hmm. treatment device. You stick your body under it, and it gives you radiation. Well, Therac 25 had a software problem, and it gave you a couple of hundred times more radiation than you needed, and it killed people. So if you're asking me, what is the consequence of a computer program problem? Well, the sky's the limit. But you're asking me to do something. You're asking me to speculate. My honest answer is, I don't know. The reality, though, is we have lots of examples of problems. In 1999, September, the Mars orbiter crashed into Mars. It didn't land. They're not supposed to do that. That was a computer problem.
That was a metric to...
It was a metric to standard imperial conversion, but essentially it's a computer problem. And right now, on CNN and all the news stations, there's this issue about a plane that crashed. That we're thinking, oh my God, it may have been some type of computer issue. Now, we're jumping the gun with that assessment because we don't know. The black boxes haven't been read. But we've had computer problems that cause deaths all the time. Another one, one more, and then let you know. Then you can ask me more. 1997, Korean Airlines Flight 801, 228 people dead. Software problem in the ground proximity warning device. Another computer problem, and 228 people died. So when you ask, what problems would it have caused? The honest answer, again, is we don't know. Oh, what's the worst that can happen? Well, you know, pick one.
But random shit we couldn't predict would happen.
Did anything go wrong that you found out about because people didn't clean the code good enough in time? Or, you know, because that's the other thing. I never heard of any reports of like, well, you know, these planes didn't crash, but this did. Yeah.
Put yourself in the position of a bank just for a moment on January the 1st. And you have a – here's the question. Do you immediately phone the bank, phone the media and tell them, oh, we have a Y2K problem at our bank. Yeah, can't get the money out.
Yeah.
There were tens of thousands of Y2K problems. I was the clearinghouse. We had these things coming in from all over the world. Now, most of them were insignificant. Some of them were more major. And then some of the results didn't come back for years. So look, there were Y2K problems. This notion that there were no problems is absolute nonsense.
Peter, is it incumbent on the system designers, system engineers to try to run simulations to detect what sort of problems might occur and head them off at the pass?
There's a whole profession that does software testing, and their whole goal is to make things crash, to make sure that they survive. Now you're going to ask, well, why didn't we do that for our programs? Well, you know what? We knew about the problem in 1970. We knew about it in 1980. And we knew about it in 1990. And the general consensus was someone else will fix that.
Right.
We don't need to worry about. We'll replace that software by then. But the reality is that we did not at that time, and still don't to a large extent, we did not understand how computer systems evolve. Well, here's what happens. Let's say I have a database with data in it that has two-digit years. Okay. So I move it into proper hard disks and everything. So I've moved it away from the paper, you know, storage devices. Now I write a new program. Well, when I write a new program, you know, it's going to be an awful lot of work to revamp all the data. So we're just going to write the new program to use the old data. Do you see what happens? It sort of propagates. Error continues to move through.
Yeah, because you only have the two-digit years in the old database. Right, okay. So that makes sense.
And then someone says, well, you know, change the data. Modify the data. Make the data right. And the manager says, well, that would imply that we're going to have to change all our programs. That's an awful lot of work for nothing, you know, for no immediate payback. Don't worry about that. You see, when I worked on Y2K, I mean, this is one of the first times I've mentioned this. I was not working on the technical problem. The technical problem, like I said at the beginning, was easy. Any programmer can fix a Y2K problem. But the problem was getting people to start fixing it. This was a change management problem from day one.
Right.
It was a communications problem. It was a problem doing something that you guys do all the time, trying to convince someone that what they believe in isn't true. And you know how difficult that can be. And no one wanted to hear this. Yeah. People would have preferred if myself and many, many others, I wasn't the only one by a long shot, many other people were talking about this, and they would rather we just shut up.
Yeah. And it is that makes sense. It is still an issue. Like, even I could, without getting into details, you know, I could tell you at you know, the electronic medical record system where I work, there are significant issues that result from the fact that, you know, they didn't want to spend $2 million to fix it. So, yeah, you could definitely see how companies in the 80s and even the early 90s wouldn't want to spend money to fix a problem that was 10, 20 years down the road and they thought would probably fix itself. And just the backward compatibility issue itself meant that, no, it's going to just propagate all the way through until you actually spend money to fix it.
And getting people to spend the money, and we did eventually get them to spend the money, we spent something like $300 billion worldwide.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
You know,
$300 billion, yeah.
And people say this was a non-event. Now, some of the other criticisms of the whole thing, and when you look backward, and you know, it was a recent podcast that focused on all the survivalists, the people who are trying to sell you gold, the ones who wanted you to buy bunkers in the hills, that was just craziness. Mm-hmm. That you know, that tapped into something that is very endemic, the survivalist thing.
We knew one of them.
Why no? Then the religious people get involved. This was the coming of the apocalypse.
Oh, yeah.
Meanwhile, the programmers, we just want to be left alone to change code. I used to get interviewed a lot. I did more than 2,000 media interviews. And towards late 1999, a reporter would ask me the following questions. Now, this is not just one reporter. This is more than a dozen different reporters. I was absolutely convinced they were using a script. The sequence would go as follows. Mr. DeAuger, do you believe that planes are safe to fly? Yes. Absolutely they are. We've done the work. Mr. DeAuger, where will you be New Year's Eve 1999? And my response was true, but it was also packaged. I wanted to give them the personal touch. I will be in a pub by the name of Gus O'Connor's in Doolin, Ireland, quaffing pints. Ah, Mr. DeAuger. So let me get the quote correct. Despite the fact that the world expert in Y2K says that planes are safe to fly, you won't be anywhere near a plane that night, will you?
Yeah.
That happened almost verbatim, more than a dozen times.
Wow.
So I finally figured out how to put an end to that particular angle.
Oh, great.
And I said, where are you going to be? They asked me, where are you going to be? I'm going to be flying on a plane. What? I was flying on United Airlines. I can't remember the flight number. United Airlines flight out of Chicago flew to Heathrow. And at the stroke of midnight, I was flying over Gander, Newfoundland, I think. Anyway, East Coast, Canada, 33,000 feet with a glass of champagne in my hand.
So you booked a flight just to shut them up, huh?
I didn't book it. I phoned up United Airlines and said, let me be on your flight. They said, sure, we'll put you on, but you know, first class. And then they flew me back. I landed, waited around for the next flight, and came home.
Oh my God.
They must have been confused. It was off the script. They didn't know what to do from there.
There's no drama.
It seems like what we need, and now that memory for this kind of stuff is not an issue. We're not scraping for every, you know, bit. There should be a future-proof compliance, you know, for software, just generically. If you write software, this is what you need to do to make sure that it's going to be, you know, not going to crash at any point in the future due to some kind of calendar issue.
Look, you're right.
Define the future, too. How far ahead?
Million years? I don't know.
Back in the day when you bought gasoline, it had the number of cents per gallon in the States, and the pumps only had the two digits. When it went to a dollar, three digits, it's an overflow problem.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. We run into overflow problems all the time, and there's no real way around them. I mean, you can write code that says, okay, no matter how big the number gets, but even that's sort of weird because numbers can get as big as they want.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we set up numbers inside the computer, they all have limits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the challenge is, look, create a number, use a number format large enough, make it a million times bigger than you could ever imagine it would possibly be. And hope that that's big enough.
Mm-hmm.
When you print a form, you allow so much space for the number. If the number gets bigger than that, you have a problem. We run into these all the time. They're usually not as endemic as the Y2K problem was, because basically every program had something that needs fixing. And the real challenge was getting people to look. I stood in front of a room full of power utility companies back in early 1997. And I said, okay, I've described the problem. How many of you know if you have a problem? No hands went up. I said, okay, fine. You've just admitted that you're ignorant about whether or not you have an issue. That's not an issue by itself. Next question. How many of you have started a project to figure out if you have a problem or not? Not one hand went up.
Too late.
At which point I just throw my – I literally threw my hands up in the air. I said, okay, guys, I can't say anything else. You know what to do. Go off and do it. You know, session's over. Right. But no, it's not up to me anymore.
You're saying what we've been saying about this, that people like simplistic stories, like black and white, like either it was going to destroy the world or it was entirely a hoax. It's like, no, you know, it was a real problem. It was fixed largely. That prevented major issues, but not all issues. There still were some problems, but not as many as there would have been if we didn't do anything. And yeah, there were some scams, but at its core, it was legitimate. But that's a little bit too much nuance, you know, for the average human brain. They just want to check a box and put it in this hole where that was either it was going to destroy the world and we saved it, you know, or that was a total scam. But as we like to say, it's always more complicated than you think.
It's always more. I did an interview yesterday with a journalist, and he said, okay, explain to me the problem. I don't understand it. Now, I was prepared for this. This was the first interview I had done. This is now the second one today. This is the first interview I had done in about 20 years, okay, because I was tired of it. It was a scam. It was a hoax, and you're a charlatan. And he says, explain it to me. I said, okay, what do you know about it? And he says, okay, two-digit year. So I go through the thing we went through earlier, and then I said, oh, do you understand? He said, well, no, not really. I said, okay, fine. So I reach into the bag I brought with me because I brought props, and I pulled out about a five-inch pad of computer code, COBOL, and I start flipping through it. I said, a lot of stuff there, right? Yep. Complicated. Yep. Fine. There are three date problems in that code. Find them. Fix them.
Oh, boy.
He says, okay, I get the idea. I said, no, you don't. That's trivial. There are billions of lines of code in a product like Google, never mind just the world. And that was the problem. It was finding needles in the haystack, some of which were okay and some which weren't. And the only way to find them were to go in and look for them. And then they were all... Like I said, there's so many different ways that 0-0 was going to cause problems.
Yeah, but it's like we talk about the fact that if you stop the epidemic from happening, then people think it was never going to be an epidemic.
We used to joke when we were in the bar towards the end, and actually in the year 2000 as well, we would have done ourselves a service if we'd actually let something blow up.
Yeah.
Yes, right.
The fact that we had no visible consequence.
Sacrificial lamb,
yeah. Yeah, and we were just trying to decide who. But we couldn't figure – today would be simple. But we didn't have a fitting candidate at all for something really bad to happen to. So we decided not to do that. But if we had if something had blown up, we would have – the story would not be it was a farce.
Mm-hmm. You would have been heroes at that point, you know, to avert all the other dangers that could have happened.
See, then it would have fallen into the disaster movie narrative, right, where there's one guy who is like denies that there's a problem. They always have to die a horrific death like two-thirds through the movie. Mm-hmm. Right? So you needed that guy for Y2K who would deny that it's a problem vocally, and then they have to go down
That's
in
right.
flames. Because
oh, the irony.
You've seen the meme, right? The one that goes, at the beginning of every disaster movie, there's a scientist telling you that something's going to blow up.
Yeah.
And we all ignore them.
And they always make the scientists look crazy.
All right. Well, Peter, thanks so much for giving us this really fun history of Y2K. We really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome, guys. I listen to you all the time and fondly think of Perry quite often.
Oh, thank you so much.
Great to hear. Gosh. Thank you so much.
Let's all hope, guys, that in 2090, a worldwide ruling AI listens to Peter's podcast and realize that it's not a hoax. Yeah.
Good point. Good point, Bob.
Take care, guys. Thanks. Be good.
Good night.
Bye.
Thank you, Peter.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. So remember I told you I have themes where I quiz you about something you know nothing about.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And then I quiz you about something you're very familiar with to see how deep your knowledge goes.
Oh boy.
That's right.
Yes, this is an example of the latter. So how familiar are you guys with the planet Earth?
Oh, Oh, Earth and I are so close. It's like
you live here
my whole life. My gosh,
your whole life. Yeah. So this is just stuff about the Earth. Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Item number one: there is a rock cycle in which igneous rock is turned into sedimentary rock, and then metamorphic rock, and then back again to either igneous or sedimentary rock. Item number two: the most common element on Earth by weight is oxygen, and that's the entire Earth. And item number three: the tallest mountain in the world from base to summit is Mauna Kea in Hawaii, which measures 10,210 meters tall, almost a mile taller than Everest. Sorry to mix those metric and imperial standards there, but almost a mile was just shorter. Evan, go first.
Okay, the rock cycle that you speak of. Igneous rock turns to sedimentary rock and then metamorphic rock and then back again to either igneous or sedimentary rock. Well, I wish I remembered these details from my, sixth or seventh grade geology class. I'm sure we went over this. I don't know if there's a cycle per se. This one, I recall learning a lot about rocks. We spent like a whole semester on rocks, I think, and I just don't recall there being the cycle. Doesn't mean that that's not true, but it's just my memory. Second one about the most common element on Earth by weight is oxygen. All right. So you think about that. A lot of oxygen in the air, a lot of oxygen in the water, and a lot of water on the planet. But there's a lot of nitrogen also in the air, but what's the weight of nitrogen compared to oxygen? And, how much nitrogen is in the oceans? Probably, there's probably a lot more oxygen. I'll say that one's right. That one, I think, is going to add up to be correct. And then this tallest mountain in the world, Mauna Kea in Hawaii, a mile taller than Everest. Well, sure. I mean, the ocean's pretty damn deep. I love looking at maps, whereas if you remove the water from the surface of the Earth, you take a look at a topographical map, it's just amazing. Try, go online and look at some of those. They're really great. I have a feeling this one's going to turn out to be true because those mountains are, the floor of the ocean just goes way down there more than we really think about. So therefore, I'll go with the rock cycle. I don't think there's a cycle that gets you all the way back to the original rocks you basically started with. So I'll say that one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
All right. So the rock cycle. I've got the dimmest memory of the existence of a rock cycle. Whether they transform as much as you say they do is, I'm a little iffy on that. I wish I listened to a little bit more of the geologic podcast. I feel like I might have a better answer. But the fact that I have a dim memory of the existence of a rock cycle is going to probably make me say that this one's science, and it's probably going to be my undoing. So let's go to the tallest mountain. Yeah, I've known that for quite a while, that Mount Everest is not the tallest. And it's definitely one of the mostly submerged mountains. Whether is it Mauna Kea, I think so, but I'm not 100% sure. But yeah, that sounds about right. So that leaves the most common element on Earth by weight is oxygen. I mean, this could easily be true or false. I really don't know, but I suspect based on how I feel about one and three, I think and this one I think. I suspect this one might be false. I'm just going to say that this one's fiction. Oxygen is fiction.
And Jay.
All right. This first one here, the rock cycle. All right. We got igneous rocks and we got sedimentary rock. And then we have metamorphic rock. And then what you're saying here is that these rocks can transform into each other, depending on what's going on down below. Yeah. Okay. So I definitely think that this one is science. Yeah, because the igneous rock, what is that? That's volcanic rock. And then it could get broken up and kind of turned into sedimentary rock. And then, back down, let's say this stuff is happening below the surface. I mean, it could get heated up, kind of melted back down into its constituent parts. So sure, okay, I definitely think that one is science. This second one here, the common element on Earth by weight is oxygen. So Earth is definitely, yeah, so oxygen can be, first off, anywhere. It could be in the ground, it could be in the sea, it could be in the air. The most common element,
I mean, I would also think this one is science because, like I said, I mean, oxygen can exist anywhere. You know, it is absolutely central to the life on our planet. Yeah, I'm going in. I'm pretty sure that one is science too. But let me look at this third one. This was the one that was bothering me. So the tallest mountain in the world, from base to summit, is Mauna Kea, in Hawaii, and it's not Mount Everest. Yeah, I am damn sure that Mount Everest is the tallest mountain. The tallest mountain. Yeah, I mean, what, you don't hear of people hiking up the mountain in Hawaii. I mean, everybody wants to go to Everest. Yeah, and wait a second here. You're saying that it's a mile taller? Almost a mile taller. No way. That one is complete bullshit. That one is definitely the fiction.
Oh, boy. So you guys are spread out
one,
again.
1, 2, 3. Where's Kara to break the tie?
Oh, I love it.
Kara.
All right. So I guess we'll take them in order. Since you guys are all spread out. Item number one, there is a rock cycle in which igneous rock is turned into sedimentary rock and then metamorphic rock and then back again to either igneous or sedimentary rock. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Jay and Bob, you think this one is science. And this one is...
Say it.
Science.
Yeah, baby.
Go back to
my dim memory was vindicated.
Science class, Evan.
Right.
Okay, this is what happens. So igneous rock is what comes out of a volcano, right? That gets broken down, eroded away.
Lava came out of a volcano.
The lava turns into igneous rock. The igneous rock gets eroded down into bits, which then get compacted down into sedimentary rock. If it gets deeper, it gets cooked under temperature and pressures deeper in the earth, which turns it into metamorphic rock. The metamorphic rock can then get pushed up back to the surface where it erodes back again into sedimentary rock, or it could get pushed deeper if it's in a subduction zone, in which case it can get brought up by a volcano and become igneous rock again, and keeps going. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
So the rocks in the earth are constantly turning over a very long period of time, but there's endless cycle. It's cool. Okay, number two, the most common element on earth by weight is oxygen. Bob, you think this one is the fiction.
I do.
Jay and Evan, you think this one is science. Uh-huh. Evan, the way you were talking, I think you interpreted that as being like on the surface of the earth. But I did clarify saying the whole earth.
So what, the whole of the earth. Iron by weight then?
But here's the thing. There's a lot of iron in the earth. There's a lot of other things.
Oh, God.
But
it's science.
Most of the stuff is bound as oxides. Right, it's bound to oxygen.
Oxy.
Exactly. So this one is the fiction.
Oh, it is.
Yes.
Oh, is it carbon?
So, no, carbon,
awesome.
Not even close.
Not even close.
All right, so now, if we are talking about the crust of the earth, right, the earth's crust, you guys know the different layers, right?
Yes.
The mantle, the core, the crust.
Inner core.
The crust, number one element in the crust is oxygen. Number two is...
Nitrogen.
Silicon.
All right, silicon, yeah.
Yeah, most of the crust of the earth is silicates.
Like the
oxygen and silicon.
Like
bound
the Horta.
What about carbon?
And then three is aluminum.
Aluminium.
Aluminium?
I always forget that one.
You should know that. Oxygen, then silicon, then aluminum. Those are one, two, and three in the crust. Now, in the whole earth, it's iron because the core of the earth is mostly iron.
I should have thought about that a little more.
Yeah. There's a lot of iron in the crust, too. That iron's in the top five or so for the crust. But if you include the core, the mantle and the core, it's definitely iron.
That's some dense metal, baby.
If you're talking about the crust, oxygen is 46.6%. Almost half of the Earth's crust by weight is oxygen. Then silicon, aluminum, then iron, then calcium, sodium, potassium, and magnesium. The tallest mountain in the world from base to summit is Mauna Kea in Hawaii, which measures 10,210 meters tall, almost a mile taller than Everest. Base to summit. The base, as Evan said, is underneath the ocean. It's on the ocean floor.
No way. This is complete BS, Steve, the tallest mountain. First of all, who the hell measures the base of a mountain from under the water? When you say base, we're talking like sea level.
I said base to summit. I said base to summit. Base to summit. That was the trick with that question.
No, this is ridiculous.
That wasn't a trick at all. You said it.
I said it. Down under the water and hiking all the way up from like 1,000 feet below the sea all the way to the top. That's, come on. You know
what? Jay, I specifically described that.
Jay, I quadruple checked this. Every reference says the exact same thing.
This is complete summit. Bunk.
The base of Mauna Kea is under the water.
I don't think anybody else in the whole world thinks that you consider the base of a mountain to start underwater.
Now, Everest has the highest peak above sea level.
Right.
At 8,849 meters. It's actually pretty high. You know, the base of the mountain is also high above sea level. So I know that was tricky. That was kind of the whole point of it. But that's why I specifically said.
Come on, it wasn't tricky. You said the height base to summit.
Summit is right there.
That doesn't mean it's not ambiguous.
Now, the biggest mountain in Hawaii is Mauna Loa, which is much more massive, but it's not quite as high as Mauna Kea. So Mauna Kea gets the prize for the tallest mountain base to summit in the world.
What's the biggest mountain in the solar system?
Olympus Mons.
Olympus Mons.
Yes,
and Mars.
Olympus Mons. 16 miles.
That's awesome. I want to go
24
there.
24 kilometers high. Oh, boy. I want to see that mother.
I want to go there.
Up close.
Yeah. Take selfies. Yeah. So cool.
Yeah, that would be cool. Go to Mars. We could see that. We could see Olympus Mons. We could see the face on Mars. God,
All the sights there.
Yeah, the Bigfoot.
Kermit the Frog. I want to see Kermit the Frog.
That forest of stuff up there. Yeah.
All right, Evan, give us the quote.
Do we have to wait until there's a few thousand cases of measles and children start to die? Will that move us? Invariably, it is the children who will suffer from our ignorance. Yes, 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 Dr. Paul Offit.
Paul, yeah, he's great.
Oh, he's fantastic.
And he is coming to Nexus. You'll be speaking for us at Nexus this year.
And speaking of Nexus, you can go to necss.org. We have opened up early registration. And if you happen to be an SGU patron and are looking for your discount, those discounts will be applicable on that website in about a week. And I will let you all know via email and other type of mind-bending communication.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait.
Yes, this year is going to be great. We're going to be doing an extravaganza. And we're also going to be having a private show, an SGU private show, which you could purchase on the nexus.org website if you want to attend that as well. So it's going to be a great year.
Yeah, we have not only Paul Offit, we have Carl Zimmer, who's also awesome, and Mary Roach.
Oh, wow.
So three great speakers and authors for our conference this year. We're really excited.
Among others.
And also, you should consider coming to the SGU and George Hrab mashup show. It's an all-day event, and that is happening at – you can go to the – it's noshow, KNOWSHOW.eventbrite.com. This is happening on – what's the date, Steve?
Friday, April 26th.
Please don't be confused. When we say that the SGU LARP, which is happening from 12 to 3, that's sold out, but the entire show is not sold out. So we have
– yeah, we still have a private show. George is going to do a concert, and we have the extravaganza in the evening. So those three things are not sold out.
That's correct. So go to noshow.eventbrite.com for tickets.
All right, guys. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve. Hey,
thanks, Steve. Feel better, Kara.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible. And don't forget that today's show is brought to you by KiwiCo. KiwiCo creates super cool hands-on projects for kids of all ages that make learning about science, technology, engineering, art, and math fun. And guess what? KiwiCo is offering the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe listeners the chance to try them for free. To redeem this offer and learn more, visit kiwico.com/skeptics.